Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lee Phillips, a widely published science writer, who examines the reasons why the world doesn't have an Ebola vaccine and the incompatibility between public health and private profit. Vernon Haltom, director of Coal River Mountain Watch, who discusses several recent developments in the long-running campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia. And Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive and co-author of the new book Back Channel to Cuba, who talks about 50 years of covert relations between the U.S. and Cuba and the current opportunity for normalization. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
40 years after the end of U.S. wars in Southeast Asia, the Obama administration is easing up on the U.S. ban on sales of lethal weapons to Vietnam. During a recent visit to Washington by Vietnam's Deputy Prime Minister Pham Binh Minh, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced the sale of P-3 Orion patrol aircraft to boost Vietnam's maritime security. These planes could allow Vietnam to detect submarines in the disputed South China Sea. The arms sale comes as Vietnam's dispute with China over islands in the South China Sea is heating up. In May, China deployed a deep-sea oil drilling rig near the disputed Paracel Islands. When vessels from the two nations repeatedly rammed each other near the rig, the naval conflict triggered protests and riots in Vietnam targeting Chinese business interests. Relations between the U.S. and Vietnam have warmed considerably since formal diplomatic ties were established 20 years ago. The U.S. is now engaged in negotiations with Vietnam on the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, a process that excludes China. Human Rights Watch says the sale of maritime aircraft to Vietnam is a mistake, since there is concern about Vietnam's human rights record, where 150 dissidents and bloggers are currently in Vietnamese prisons. Private Medicare Advantage plans for senior citizens are under growing scrutiny for aggressively using patient risk scores to boost reimbursement rates from Medicare. Research from the Department of Health and Human Services recommends new, tougher auditing standards to review payments made to Medicare Advantage insurance plans. Sicker patients command higher rates than healthier ones, but the industry has been criticized for allegedly overstating how sick some patients are in order to boost Medicare revenue, a practice known as upcoding. The aim of the proposed new audits is to flag and stop upcoding. Medicare expects to pay private Medicare Advantage insurance plans over $160 billion this year. These health plans are popular since they provide extra benefits and can charge less out-of-pocket expenses than traditional Medicare. Yet several whistleblower lawsuits are pending in federal courts accusing Medicare Advantage plans of overstating how sick their patients are in order to boost corporate profits. In June, the Center for Public Integrity released a study charging that Medicare paid $70 billion to cover overbilling due to deliberately inflated risk scores between 2008 and 2013. Currently, two insurance companies, United Health Group and Humana, control 40% of the Medicare Advantage market. The state of Arizona has settled a major prisoner lawsuit, agreeing to improve health care for inmates and reform solitary confinement rules for incarcerated individuals with mental illness. The agreement covers 33,000 inmates in Arizona state prisons. While Arizona Department of Corrections Commissioner Charles Ryan did not admit to any wrongdoing, the state has agreed to seek new funding to boost healthcare staffing levels, offer cancer screening for older inmates, and monitor prisoners with chronic diseases. A class action lawsuit against the Corrections Department, filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and Prison Law Office in 2012, cited the case of an Arizona inmate with a history of prostate cancer who had to wait 2 years for a biopsy. In the settlement, the Arizona Department of Corrections agreed to meet 100 healthcare performance standards and allow inmates' attorneys to monitor compliance. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As the death toll from the Ebola epidemic in West Africa tops 4,500, including 236 health workers, the World Health Organization admitted that it failed to organize an effective response to the deadly virus. The international agency blamed factors ranging from internal politics to poor communication between infectious disease experts and officials at its UN headquarters. The WHO has projected that by December 1st, the number of new Ebola cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone would be 5,000 to 10,000 per week, making the 2014 outbreak of the disease the largest in world history. In the U.S., President Barack Obama appointed a White House czar to organize the nation's Ebola preparedness, as the spread of the disease has thus far been limited to two nurses that treated Thomas Duncan, who died of the virus in a Dallas hospital on October 8th. In advance of the U.S. midterm elections on November 4th, a number of U.S. politicians have called for a ban on travel to and from the three West African nations where the Ebola outbreak is centered. This despite warnings from public health experts who warn that such restrictions would hamper efforts to stop the spread of the virus. One important question about the international response to Ebola has largely been unaddressed. Why is it that the world doesn't yet have an Ebola vaccine, despite the fact that this virus has been known to science since its emergence in South Sudan in 1976? Your reporter spoke with Lee Phillips, a widely published science writer, who examined this question in his article titled "The Political Economy of Ebola," where he discusses the incompatibility between public health and private profit.
A lot of people, when they're looking at this issue, are going to instinctively think that, oh, well, it's because it's people in Africa, they're very poor, that's why we aren't solving this problem. There's a certain element of truth to that, but the reality is that Ebola has a lot in common with a number of other diseases that are affecting people in North America and Western Europe. The pharmaceutical companies aren't responding to those diseases for the very same reason that they aren't responding in the case of Ebola. And what I mean by this is that Ebola is not a disease that you want to be having to, as a patient, you want to have to be dealing with every day for the rest of your life because, well, you're going to die fairly quickly. It's not like a chronic disease, say like diabetes, where you can take drugs, you can take insulin every day for the rest of your life. That set of chronic diseases are much, much, much more profitable for pharmaceutical companies than diseases that basically have to be solved. So this is the situation with the development of vaccines. Vaccines are not very profitable to big pharmaceutical companies at all. For the last 30 years or so, we've actually had quite a bit of a problem trying to get pharmaceutical companies to invest in more research into vaccines. So for exactly this reason, you take a vaccine maybe once, twice at most over the course of your entire life. You have the one shot, then you have a booster. That's about it, really. It's not a very profitable market. We have the same problem with antibiotics. Again, for about 30 years, we've seen a discovery void. This is the term that's used in research journals and in the pharmaceutical community itself to describe what's happened. For about 30 years now, pharmaceutical companies have really been very reluctant to engage in any research into new classes of antibiotic. And this means that we are running out of antibiotics that are effective. We have about 5 to 20 years left of the current antibiotics that we have in the cabinet before we start seeing fairly large increases in the rates of death due to bacterial infections. Already, about 2 million Americans annually are infected by bacterial infections from antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and 23,000 of them die every year from these infections.
And Lee, I wanted to ask you this. Given the fact that there seems to be an incompatibility between private for-profit pharmaceutical corporations and the needs of public health, in this case of the outbreak of Ebola in Western Africa and many other health problems that are not being addressed by private pharmaceutical companies, what is the solution here that you found from your research? Do governments have to provide a monetary incentive to pharmaceuticals to make it profitable for them? Or should governments around the world work together to directly fund this research in their own laboratories?
Well, this is the big question. There are two possible responses to this. The first, which is what has been proposed so far by different stakeholders in this discussion, has been for the government to fill the gap. And the way that that could happen would be where the public sector fills the financial gap. They figure out some way to encourage the pharmaceutical companies to engage in the necessary research, whether this is by subsidies or promised purchases, or in some cases, the promise of vouchers to pharmaceutical companies that they can use to accelerate the approval process of any other drug in their own cabinet, if you will, or patent extensions is another possibility. All of these basically amount to subsidies to the pharmaceutical industry. Meanwhile, the pharmaceutical sector gets to continue to make its profitable drugs and keep those profits. The argument that I make in this article, and a few other people make a similar argument as well, is that instead of that option, what we could do is we could take the same approach that most OECD countries took in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, which was to take healthcare into the public sector. Now, the United States never really got around to doing that, with a few exceptions, but that was only ever half the task. The rest of the task is to take the pharmaceutical industry into the public sector and to turn it into a sort of national pharmaceutical service, if you will, akin to what exists in the UK, the National Health Service. And the reason I argue for this, which is a more radical approach to the question, is that it will simply cost us less. Once it's brought into the public sector, we can redirect the revenues from those profitable drugs to subsidize the research into the unprofitable diseases. And so overall, it would cost society far less. And we then just democratically can make a decision about what needs to be researched, instead of the priorities for research being directed on the basis of the profit motive. On the basis of popular mobilization, we can begin to widen the window of policy possibility. And as far-fetched as the idea of bringing anything, any new part of the economy into the public sector, things that seem far-fetched can become common sense overnight as a result of popular mobilization and strong evidence. 20 years ago, it was unimaginable that we could see gay marriage, and today it's becoming the norm in most Western countries. And so I'm hoping that we can begin to open the discussion about, is the pharmaceutical sector such an important part of our economy that, like a fire service or the police or the army, that these things are just simply too important to leave to the private sector, and we should begin to think about bringing it into the public sector. And right now, the priority in progressive communities discussing healthcare needs to be about this, needs to be about bringing the pharmaceutical sector into the public sector.
That was Lee Phillips, a widely published science writer, talking about his article, The Political Economy of Ebola. Find links to this piece and other news and commentary about the world response to Ebola by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. There's lots of news from southern Appalachia on the fight against mountaintop removal coal mining. On October 1st, federal judge Amy Jackson Berman upheld the authority of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to withdraw a previously issued mountaintop removal mining permit for Arch Coal's Spruce No. 1 mine because the company's operations violated the Clean Water Act. Then a report from the U.S. Geological Survey confirmed elevated levels of mountaintop removal airborne toxic dust in mining communities. The report found that the dust comes from mountaintop removal operations and not from other sources. Residents living in these areas have higher rates of several serious illnesses associated with this type of dust exposure. Also on October 9th, a lab technician who is certified by the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection recently admitted to falsifying reports for coal companies' water quality tests. A federal investigation is ongoing. Despite gathering evidence about the environmental harm and danger to human health caused by mountaintop removal mining, West Virginia's Department of Environmental Protection has given out 25 new mountaintop mining permits over the last 2 years as companies attempt to work around Clean Water Act restrictions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Vernon Haltom, director of Coal River Mountain Watch in West Virginia, who discusses some of these recent developments which bolster the case against mountaintop removal mining.
Last week, the United States Geological Survey released a new report, the first one from a U.S. government agency, identifying mountaintop removal dust in communities at elevated levels. And it's a type of dust known to cause lung and heart problems. And then just yesterday, we found out that there's another new study from mostly folks at the West Virginia University School of Public Health regarding mountaintop removal dust and its direct link to human lung cancer. And the dots are connected so strongly. And this is the first one that makes that direct connection as showing the cause rather than just a correlation. So that is, it's big news. It's kind of depressing because now we have this lab experiment that shows that, yes, the dust that we've been breathing does promote human lung cancer, and that's very unsettling.
Showing causation rather than just correlation is really important. But you had indications before this about the health impacts of mountaintop removal, right?
That's right. We've had the statistical evidence that, you know, even after accounting for other factors such as socioeconomic status and things like that, that the cancer rates, heart disease rates, birth defect rates, mortality, depression, all of those things are higher in mountaintop removal areas. And that's after taking into account those other factors. But this is the first one that actually links the mountaintop removal dust to cancer. You know, I consider it a landmark study, and one of the scientists, Dr. Michael Hendricks, says that it's one of the most important ones so far. And that's, it's very important. The study actually calls for, like, what are we going to do about it? You know, the report supports prudent adoption of prevention strategies and exposure control. So we're thinking, what kind of prevention strategies and exposure control can we do? I mean, can we live in a bubble? Do we have to evacuate? Do we all get respirators? Or do we fight it? Do we end it? And we have a way of doing that, and that's the ACAC, Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act. The ACAC, H.R. 526, is the way that we see would be a good and swift end to mountaintop removal and protect human health. And what it does is it would place a moratorium on new or enlarged mountaintop removal sites unless and until the U.S. Department of Health and Human Resources conducts and publishes a thorough, definitive study showing that this does not harm our health. And the way that it would work is the moratorium would go in place immediately. And then if the study shows that, yeah, it's not harming your health, there's no evidence for that, then they could go about getting new permits again. In the meantime, we would have that pause, and we see it as an example of the precautionary principle. You know, you don't do something to people unless you know it's relatively safe.
Vernon Haltom, there was another development recently that made a pretty big splash. A judge ruled that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, could revoke a permit it previously granted to the Spruce No. 1 mountaintop removal site because the company was violating the Clean Water Act. I know the coal industry and a lot of politicians in coal country thought that was pretty outrageous.
The EPA, when they see that something is violating the law, they can withdraw a permit. And there's a lot of hoopla about this particular site, and even friends of mine thought that mountaintop removal was banned or that the EPA had ended any new mountaintop removal permits, and that's nowhere near the case. Even at Spruce No. 1, there's a large portion of that is still being mined as of this day. And that particular case only protected a couple of streams. The latest court victory saying that the EPA does have the right to retroactively veto a mountaintop removal permit is important, it is significant, but it's not the end of mountaintop removal. And the EPA has shown no indication that they're going to veto any other permits.
That was Vernon Haltom, director of Coal River Mountain Watch in West Virginia. Find more news and information on the campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Hostility between the United States and Cuba has been a central feature of the Cold War years and well beyond. In fact, the U.S. diplomatic isolation and economic embargo against Cuba continues, long after Washington normalized relations with both Communist China and Vietnam, a nation against which the U.S. prosecuted a failed 10-year war, costing more than 58,000 American lives. But a new book, Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, reveals that behind the scenes, the U.S. and Cuban governments maintained secret communications, often via covert intermediaries, that included dialogue and negotiations on a range of issues, including repeated efforts to improve relations. One previously unknown potential crisis point described in the book were plans for an all-out U.S. war against Cuba, initiated in 1976 by then-Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who was outraged that Fidel Castro deployed Cuban troops to Angola in the mid-1970s to defend the African nation against CIA and South African-sponsored rebels. Your reporter spoke with Peter Kornbluh, director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, and co-author, along with William Leo Grand, of the new book, Back Channel to Cuba. Here, Kornbluh talks about the 50 years of covert negotiations between the U.S. and Cuba, and his view that the time is now right for normalizing diplomatic and economic relations between the two nations.
Well, overall, we wanted to do a project that kind of balances the historical narrative on Cuba. I think when many of us think of U.S.-Cuban relations, we think of what Kissinger himself called the perpetual antagonism of the U.S. position towards Cuba. We think of CIA assassination plots, the Bay of Pigs invasion, Operation Mongoose, the trade embargo. We don't think about the fact that for almost all of this time since the Cuban Revolution, there has been secret talks, secret communications, and several major efforts to actually normalize relations that have been undertaken in secret between these two countries. We have the enemies of dialogue with Cuba basically saying you can't talk to Cuba. But the truth of the matter is that every president since Eisenhower has talked to Cuba. Obama now has the opportunity to sit down with Raul Castro during this last period of Obama's presidency perhaps, you know, have a discussion that leads to a breakthrough in this long impasse of U.S. hostility towards Cuba. So that was the general reason for trying to put this untold history together in one place at this time. It did take 10 years, but of course it was always intended to come out right when it mattered, and I think that's the case today.
Peter, having studied U.S.-Cuba relations all these years and researched and dug through the archives for this book, what are the main reasons you think all these attempts at normalizing relations between Cuba and the United States failed in all these years since 1961?
Some of them failed because U.S. officials took an incremental approach. They wanted quid pro quos from Cuba, and they wanted to go step by step, and they basically extended this out over a period of time during which enemies of the process, from anti-Castro exiled terrorists to political figures in Miami to very, very powerful senators and congressmen on Capitol Hill in Washington, could push back and oppose this kind of sequential long-term effort. They have taken place sometimes and kind of fallen into an election year. I can think of 1964, 1994, and a couple of other election years in which Cuba just becomes a political football. Ronald Reagan, for example, challenged Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford's kind of concept on détente with the Soviet Union, better relations with China, and an effort to bring détente to the Caribbean during the primaries of the 1976 election. It became very politically difficult for the Ford administration to move forward. And you have simply times when Cuba has not had it as a priority to normalize relations with the United States and has had other priorities that conflict politically with the success of those types of talks with the United States.
You have talked about the fact that there's an upcoming summit meeting of the Americas in Panama in April of 2015, and that both
Cuba's head of state, Raul Castro, and President Barack Obama will both be there. And it's possible that they could sit down, the hope of optimists here for normalization, that they could sit down and hammer out something or at least begin a dialogue on normalizing before Obama leaves office. In the context of U.S. politics and Little Havana down there in Miami and the power that they wield in U.S. elections, how realistic is it that this could be the moment when normalization is viable, is possible?
Well, we're living in a moment in which the power of the anti-Castro lobby in Miami and Florida has waned considerably. And now it's majority opinion in the state of Florida for better relations, for more travel, for more remittances, for a different policy towards Cuba. Obama's not running for re-election, nor does he have to protect Hillary Clinton, who clearly is running because she's already staked out a position. She's read the tea leaves in Florida, and she understands that an argument to lift the embargo would actually not only get her more votes in Florida, but probably bigger donations from significantly wealthy Cuban Americans who themselves would like to now return to Cuba and invest now that the Cuban economy is changing. So politically, the stars are aligned. In terms of opportunity, as you pointed out, there's this summit meeting in April in Panama. Both Cuba and the United States have been invited. Cuba has said it will go. The United States has not said yet, really. But if Obama doesn't go, he'll be basically offending the other heads of state of the entire Latin American region. So you finally have a moment in which a president of the United States and a president of Cuba could be sitting across from each other at a regional conference table for the first time since the Cuban Revolution. And you can imagine that there'll be tremendous pressure and a tremendous buildup on President Obama to lay the groundwork before the summit for better relations. And then, you know, with a handshake, perhaps smoking a cohiba with Raul Castro, emerge from this summit with news that finally there is, as Obama himself has called for, a new day, a new beginning in the U.S.-Cuban relationship.
That was Peter Kornbluh, director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive and co-author, along with William Leo Grand, of the new book, Back Channel to Cuba. Learn more about the diplomatic signals that may indicate a new era of warming U.S.-Cuba relations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.